From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Mitt Romney and the 47% more rage in the Muslim world. A strike ends the rap on Fast and Furious. A bootleg video from a Romney fundraiser shakes up the campaign.
47% will win.
President Obama hit back in a new forum on the Spanish language Univision network.
When you express an attitude that half the country considers itself victims, that somehow they want to be dependent on government. My thinking is maybe you haven't gotten around a lot.
And more protests. Protesters tried to reach the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad, Pakistan. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Ginger Gibson of Politico, Trudy Rubin of the Philadelphia Inquirer, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? The 47% Afghanistan Fast and Furious Chicago? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us from Washington is Ginger Gibson, national political reporter for Politico. They've been in the middle of the Romney restart story. She's been traveling with the Romney campaign. Ginger Gibson, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
With us from Philadelphia, Trudy Rubin. She writes the World View column for the Philadelphia Inquirer, an eye that goes everywhere globally. Trudy Rubin, welcome back to you as well.
Great to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Ginger, and Trudy.
All right, let's hear a little bit more of that bootleg tape heard around the world, and then how Mitt Romney came in to say more about it. But here it was. This was, we now learn, Mother Jones got this at a private home, pretty big one, in Boca Raton, May 17th. And we've all seen the video. But here's a little more about that, the story as he was telling it.
47% of Americans pay no income tax. So our message of low taxes doesn't connect. He'll be out there talking about tax cuts for the rich. I mean, that's what they sell every 4 years. And so my job is not to worry about those people. I'll never convince them that they should take personal responsibility and care for their lives.
I'll never convince them, he says. On Tuesday, here he was with Fox News, trying to explain his controversial elite comments, saying, look, I want everybody to succeed.
We should have enough jobs and enough take-home pay such that people have the privilege of higher incomes that allow them to be paying taxes. I think people would like to be paying taxes.
Ginger Gibson, how tough was this hit for the Romney campaign? And in the pushback, you said this can be a good clarifying moment for me. How are they doing in getting around it, turning it around?
They're trying to take this video in which he appears to be saying he's not concerned or trying to persuade 47% of the nation's population into a conversation about entitlements. What the early polling numbers were seeing is that those who saw the video and were undecided, it made them less likely to vote for Romney. But Republicans and conservatives think that it could be a positive thing where it forces a more detailed discussion about entitlements and about those programs that he's already opposed before.
Trudy Rubin, how do you see it? The Romney campaign trying to put a good face on this, but you listen and it's, you know, he's definitely saying 47% of the country kind of characterizing as freeloaders. That's a lot of people. Now, we know elections are won at margins. We know he was talking with funders here. President Obama had his guns and religion comment 4 years ago. But how do you see this one playing out, Trudy?
Well, first of all, it puts paid to all the Republican attempts to claim that it's the Democrats that are stirring up class warfare when Romney is speaking to a very rich country club group and basically sneering at the 47% who don't pay income taxes. As we know and has been widely written, many of those people are paying payroll taxes. Many of them earn too little, according to our tax makeup, to pay income taxes. Another large chunk are retired and therefore earn too little on Social Security pay taxes. The thing that I think is most ironic is that there's probably a large segment of the 47% who might tend towards Republican voting or be Republican voters because of social issues. So I think it's the sneering tone, the disdain, the sort of Ayn Randian approach that those who have are the good people and those who are poorer are the moochers. That just casts a pall on Romney's image and might even influence some people who might vote Republican. On the other hand, you don't know how many people will really follow this debate.
Well, hard to miss it this week. Mitt Romney trying to dig out this on this really interesting Spanish language network Univision forum. This was University of Miami. And here he was, you can hear Jack, I'll come to you, but here he was repeatedly emphasizing, never mind 40%, saying he wants to reach out to 100% of Americans.
This is a campaign about the 100%. And over the last several years, you've seen greater and greater divisiveness in this country. We had hoped to come back together, but instead you've seen us pull apart, and politics has driven us apart in some respects. So my campaign is about the 100% of America, and I'm concerned about them.
Jack, he's come back out and said, look, I care about everybody, but you've got to have an economy where people are in the game so they can make a living and pay taxes.
Well, you know, that should have been his strongest argument all along, but it hasn't gained traction, and you have to wonder why. Unemployment is still high. Americans are officially worse off than they were 4 years ago. The median income fell under President Obama, and the president's job approval number is still in the danger zone. So why hasn't Romney gained? You know, an unhappy verb doomed his father's presidential candidacy. George Romney said he had been brainwashed by the brass in Vietnam. Trying to avoid his father's self-administered wound, Mitt Romney repeats it, wounding himself again and again with these inelegant, as he calls it, utterances. He's a self-subverting presidential candidate. And the question is, would he be a self-subverting president?
Ginger, Politico has been looking a lot at Republicans who have been disgruntled and expressing it in the last week with this candidacy. Is it a matter of somebody who's inelegant? Is it? I mean, what is the critique that's coming down?
Republicans look at the numbers in this election and think it's entirely winnable. Unemployment above 8%, mm-hmm. falling incomes. People are struggling. And so with that many unhappy and out-of-work people, it should be easy for Republicans to capitalize on that unhappiness and go in and have a really strong showing. And yet, the poll numbers aren't good. We look at swing states, and Mitt Romney is down in Virginia, down in Florida, down in Ohio, down in Nevada, down in New Hampshire. And they're getting unhappy, and they're blaming the way the campaign has been run. They started naming names, looking at specific staffers, and they're unhappy with Mitt Romney. I mean, we have to remember that coming out of the primary, Republicans did not all jump on the Mitt Romney bandwagon. They weren't all thrilled with him as a candidate, and some of that unhappiness is coming back to the surface. They think that he's not capitalizing, he's not out campaigning enough, he keeps too light a schedule, his messaging is all over the place, and he's not going after the administration in the ways that they wish he would.
Ginger, I mean, Republicans really want to win this election. You can feel it, and they could taste it. Are you guys cherry-picking disgruntled Republicans with your reporting?
I would say absolutely not. I talk to conservatives, moderates, establishment, and I'm hearing unhappiness. There's a lot of, and self-admittedly, you know, armchair quarterbacking going on, guys that are sitting around and saying, I would do this different. But it's an unhappiness. And in the early part of the summer, when you'd see something and you'd call a bunch of Republicans and they'd sort of mumble and they'd say, oh, but, you know, we're going to beat Obama. And that has changed. In the last month, the number of people who are just outright criticizing the Republican campaign, the Republican nominee's campaign, Mitt Romney's campaign, has grown. And it's starting to be on the record. We look at Peggy Noonan just writing that the campaign's a calamity. And those kind of people are coming out more now and being even stronger in their criticism.
Jack, what do you see in the polls that keep coming out? And we're now, what, just a couple of months nearly from election?
Well, it's just been really bad for Mitt Romney, as Ginger said, in all those battleground state polls. But most ominously of all, the polls show that Mr. Obama and Mr. Romney are now both tied on the who would do better on the economy measure. That was Romney's strong suit. That was the thing that kept him up. Now they're just about tied on it. And now 39% think the United States is going in the right direction. That sounds terrible, but that's actually the highest this since 2009. So there's a sense that maybe feelings about the economy are shifting, and voters are seeing the two candidates as pretty much equal in how they would fix the economy.
Trudy, is there a flip side on this, Trudy? You know, you follow the world. You see what's happened in Europe. They've got a lot of social programs there, and they've got a lot of trouble. Is Mitt Romney trying to warn this country away from that, or are you just see a kind of class war from the top down here?
Whatever he's trying to do, the message is not coming out clearly. As Jack said, he had had a clear message about we want to get all of you to work, the 100%, the unemployment figures obviously give him a wonderful opportunity. And he could talk about entitlements, although I think he will be dogged by Paul Ryan's current and previous positions on basically dismantling Medicare. However, he's not going that route. He is basically setting up a distinction between the haves, and it's not the have-nots. It's the working poor, it's the working class, and it's much of the middle class. And if you set up that dichotomy and you're caught denigrating hardworking people who do pay payroll taxes, that does not get across the idea that what your main concern is job creation.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about a week in the news, more Muslim raids. We've seen it all over. Romney on the 47%. Latino American Univision with its interesting forum, pressing hard on both candidates, Obama and Mitt Romney. Ginger Gibson is with us in Washington from Politico. Trudy Rubin in Philadelphia with the Philadelphia Inquirer. And our own Jack Beatty is here. We've got lots of callers and lots of issues to get to. But let's get here. Laura in Dedham, Massachusetts. Laura, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I wanted to say two things really quickly. One is that a big irony hardly commented on is that Romney extremely aggressively avoids taxes, and then he aggressively defends it. And Ann Romney says, oh, well, if we revealed our tax returns, we'd just be grilled about it. And there's an industry devoted to finding ways for the rich to avoid taxes. So this comprises his worldview of taxes. If you take that the rich are to avoid taxes, they can shelter things offshore, but the poor and the poorer should be paying higher taxes. And they should be disdained for not paying them or for taking advantage of tax credits and things like that. Second, he doesn't seem to really know very many people, if any, in that so-called 47%. And I'm not sure how much the press does either, because the idea that there's any kind of a tenable theory that people would be better citizens if they were invested in paying federal income taxes, when if you actually talk to someone who makes, you know, $40,000 a year, they're crushed by the mixture of their living expenses and the taxes that they do pay. And, you know, they pay property taxes. Whether they rent or own, they end up paying property taxes. They pay local taxes. They pay payroll taxes. And
Laura, we've got it. People in the game in different ways. Mitt Romney aggressive in saying he's been followed the letter of the law in his in his tax payment strategy, and of course he's looked to go low, but then there's a lot of money there. We'll come to it. One more, Paula, Waterbury, Connecticut. Paula, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay.
I just want to make a quick comment. I don't think Romney was wrong when he said that 48% of the Americans are on aid. He's right. There is about 48%, or maybe more, of American citizens that receive either federal or state aid in some format. I don't think he was degrading them. I think he was just stating a mere fact.
Well, but he said they have a victim mentality. If somebody works all their life and now they're on Social Security, are they looking at themselves as a victim or just a working person who's now retired and they're getting their Social Security that they paid in on?
Well, I think you can split hairs and split those into other groups, but I think there are a lot of people in this country that are born into welfare and they stay on it and they die on welfare. And I think there's a lot of people that don't really want to address their own problems. They want to have the government kind of do a lot for them. That's their philosophy, fine, but it's not mine. I've been working since I was 14 years old, and I've got a good career. Nobody handed me anything. I worked my way through college.
Paula, we've got it. Jack Beatty, speak to this. This is a not at all uncommon Republican narrative on this country's situation. And you know Mitt Romney was looking to speak to it that night in those fancy quarters there in Boca Raton. But who's a bum here and who's not, Jack? The awful lot of Americans get swept up in 47%.
Yes, that was an aggressive estimate. I think Paula should be congratulated for her, you know, self-made status, and that's admirable. But you know, over the years, American individualism, economic individualism, has become, polls show this, I'm not making this up, there's scholarly research, it's become considerably racialized. That is to say, people on polls answer that, other people are lazy and on welfare, and if you follow that through, it's often minority people. I'm not saying that was what Paula said. She didn't say it. But that's what these studies say. And increasing...
That's what people are thinking.
Yes, that's what people are thinking. And if you ask white Americans what percentage of the population are African American, they're up around 28%. It's actually 12. If you ask them how many, what the percentage of Hispanics is, it's in the high teens. It's not. And so there's your 47% right there.
Well, what do you mean by that? If you look at the 47%, it has to be a lot of white people in there.
Of course not, but I'm just saying that when polls ask whites, you know, to name the percentage of blacks, they vastly over increase it, and I think that this is part of this sort of slightly racialized discourse about who's dependent and who's not.
Ginger, does Mitt Romney come closer with that kind of line to getting that swing vote that he very explicitly says he needs there? And of course, Obama needs a swing vote too, but is it out there for Romney with this approach?
We know that Romney's campaign is heavily targeting working class voters in Ohio, so one of the swing states that they have to win. And so there are some undecided, some independents in there who, particularly if we're going to talk about race politics, are white males that he can win their vote. White working class traditional Democrats who could be won over to the Republican vote. And I think one of the most important things when we look at this 47% video, and I think that these two callers might give us a great example of that, which is, like, do people identify as part of that 47%? Do people who aren't paying federal income tax but are paying a payroll tax consider themselves part of that and think Mitt Romney is talking about them? And that's going to be a big chunk of those working class voters in Ohio. Or do they not think that it's them? And do they feel that Mitt Romney is calling them victims and them as being people who are living off the government dole? Or do they think he's talking about the others, a group of people that they think are getting from the government when they're not and still struggling?
Let's go to Steve in Dothan, Alabama. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Couple things. As I say, one of the things on the whole Romney thing is, you know, the 47%, it's such a wide range of folks that you guys don't talk about that. There are people who, they're on both sides, who don't pay taxes, who are either going to be completely
sure
Romney supporters or completely Obama supporters.
Absolutely.
That's what he's trying to say, but there's a lot of, but he really, it's missing the whole point of we're 16 point whatever trillion in debt, and we have entitlements off the yin-yang, and everything is, as I say, we can't afford the direction we're going,
yep,
yet we're still throwing more at it and more at it, but no one is even talking about going back to 98 and 94, then State Senator Obama's whole, I'm into redistribution and taking money from people who have it and giving it to them and feeding that entitlement mentality, which is not getting any coverage at all.
Well, I mean, it has had, Romney's camp has paid a lot of attention to it. This was from Barack Obama, was in the Illinois State Legislature, quite right, Steve, and that was picked up this week. Mitt Romney made a lot out of it, Ginger, 14-year-old video where a markedly younger-looking Barack Obama is saying, you know, I favor income redistribution to a point. And I guess he's saying to help us do this and help us do that in society. What about bringing that up? Is that fair game at this point, Ginger? Does that sway voters?
So an interesting thing about this video is that after that clip surfaced and Romney's campaign was pointing to it and it appeared on Drudge, which we know has a very close tie to the Romney campaign, the rest of the video came out. And in the next sentence, Obama is saying he wants this to happen through a fair, competitive system in which market forces are allowed to compete fairly. And this is no different than the message we heard Barack Obama say in 08 and that we hear Barack Obama saying now. Yes, everyone was sort of like making a big deal out of this redistribution word. And that is a really weighted word and carries a lot of signals with it. But when we listen to the whole thing, we know that it's no different from the message that he's given now. Also, it's a video from 1998, which sort of didn't give it the weight that the Romney video from May got and try to looking at these things. It was a public speech. It wasn't secret. It wasn't hidden. It wasn't this get where we were seeing something we weren't supposed to. So those sort of factors played in this week and why we were talking still on the end of the week more about Romney than about that Obama video.
Jack, income redistribution to a point is a kind of a thumbnail summary of what the then state legislator Obama said. I mean, hasn't that been American policy for a long time? And we've had, you know, we had much higher income tax rates in the heart of the 20th century. Hasn't income redistribution to a point been the way we sort of move wealth around and build stuff in this country to a point?
Yes, to a point. I mean, we had inheritance taxes. We had 91% rate as late as the 1950s in progressive taxation. And, of course, Democrats have fired back, and they've cited this Tax Policy Center analysis, which shows that Romney's tax plan would redistribute income upward. That is, it would increase after-tax income for those making more than $200,000 annually while lowering it for everyone else. So redistribution one way, redistribution the other.
But you hear our caller saying, come on, somebody has to worry about this big debt. And he hears Romney playing more of that music.
Yes, and I think this is one of there have been many, but one of the great disappointments of this campaign, maybe we'll get it in the debates, where we will have people saying, what do you, you know, how far can we go with Medicare? What will be the future as the baby boomers increasingly retire? Can we just be a country that has a defense budget and a Medicare budget? What's the answer? We haven't even begun to open that conversation.
I want to dive into another form. This was a really interesting one. Univision, the Spanish language TV network that's all over the U.S., wanted to play a part in the presidential debates. They didn't get that. They set up their own forum. It was really compelling. Latino journalists questioning the two candidates on subsequent nights. And it was lots of Latinos in the audience. And it was really interesting, kind of a glimpse of this country's future or a big piece of it that's coming up here. Here's a bit on Thursday. There's moderator Jorge Ramos pressing President Obama on why he had not delivered on what Ramos called a campaign promise of comprehensive immigration reform.
A promise is a promise. And with all due respect, but you didn't keep that promise.
Well, here's what I would say, Jorge, is that, and we've had this conversation before. There's the thinking that the president is somebody who is all powerful and can get everything done. We have to have cooperation from all these sources in order to get something done.
The president, hey, there's only so much I can do. On the night before, the same thing, the Univision Forum, lots of Latinos dialing in here, normally Spanish language, but obviously this one in English. And here the co-moderator, Maria Elena Salinas, pressing Mitt Romney over his stance on illegal immigrants and the young in particular.
If you become president, are you going to deport them or not?
Well, we're not.
Yes or no?
We're not going to round up people around the country and deport them. That's not. I said during my primary campaign, time and again, we're not going to round up 12 million people. That includes the kids and the parents and have everyone deported. Our system isn't to deport people. We need to provide a long-term solution. And I've described the fact that I would be in support of a program that said that people who served in our military could be permanent residents of the United States.
Mitt Romney dancing there, Obama dancing there. I mean, we'll come to the details, but Trudy Rubin, this was an interesting and new kind of glimpse of the future here. Sharp, pointed Latino journalist with a big audience, with a big forum for these two candidates, with them really on the spot.
Yes, well, I don't think, at least as far as that clip goes, that Romney was too convincing, since we do deport people, and he mentioned only those who had served in the military, whereas we just saw those wonderful scenes of young people who now will be able to stay legally, who grew up here or but were the children of illegals and came here as small children, something that Obama did do. I think it's quite astonishing that Romney and the Republicans have proved so inept at appealing to the Hispanic vote, a community with conservative social values, if one can generalize. And there just has been no imagination. The program that President George W. Bush came up with to try to rationalize the illegals who are already here and to have a program of guest workers, the Republicans seem to have abandoned. So Romney has missed this great opportunity, and it didn't sound from the clips you played that he was able to get across a message that would convincingly woo the Hispanic vote.
Well, he was certainly reaching out in this form, as he has before, to say, look, I think Latinos, Mitt Romney has said, are natural Republicans. Ginger, did you see here a leaf turning in American politics with this? I mean, they went after President Obama. You know, a promise is a promise, Mr. President, on comprehensive immigration reform. Is it going to satisfy that audience for him to say, well, I can't do it alone, the Congress isn't with me, I need cooperation?
In talking to some Hispanics, particularly in Florida, there's unhappiness with the changes to the immigration laws. But there's also a lot of unhappiness with Mitt Romney. I mean, his numbers, his poll numbers among Hispanic voters are pretty awful. I mean, he needs at least 30, 40 in states like Florida and Nevada and Colorado, and he's not getting them. And they're unhappy with the immigration policy as well. Mitt Romney's tried to make this not about immigration, has just pretty much run from the issue as much as he could, not talked about it unless he has to, and tried to make it about the economy, looking at economic numbers, particularly for Hispanics. That has not worked as well for him as he might have hoped, and his poll numbers continue to languish among Hispanic voters. But it's clear that there is a moment where Republicans could find more support among Hispanic voters, and instead they're losing it. I mean, you look at the numbers George W. Bush got coming from Texas, where he had a lot of favorability with Hispanics, did a lot to work, particularly in education programs for Hispanics, and the Republican Party has lost that support that they enjoyed, you know, within the last decade.
Mitt Romney, Jack, saying that our system isn't to deport people. Well, I don't know. On the other hand, he's praised Arizona as a model for the nation.
Yes,
in the Times
yes.
reporting today, where it's much easier for police to round up folks. Do we have a straightforward response here?
Not really. And the Times goes on to say he gave a disappointing response, but really so did the president. I mean, he speaks of these wonderful kids, the dreamers. There are only 1.7 million of them. They've only got this 2-year grace period. And meanwhile, he said, really, he when he had a chance to do something about the 11 million, he didn't. And my thinking is that was straight politics. He didn't want the Democrats to have to cast a tough vote in states, you know, Democrats from states like West Virginia. They have to make a tough vote on legalizing the undocumented. And so I think that they were right to hold his feet to the fire on that. And this may come back to hurt the president. You know, polls still show Republican intensity is higher by as much as 9 points in one recent poll than the Democrats. They want to vote more than Democrats do. And I think that difference, some of that goes to the Hispanic vote. Hispanic voters just don't think, well, I don't know, he didn't do anything for us. Yes, he did something for the dreamers, but that's only for a few. That may actually come back to hurt the president.
A very interesting media moment, I thought, with the two right there in the midst of a very Latino issue-oriented, and more than that, setting. Hey, you can have your debates, you know, everybody else, but we are going to have a voice here, and we saw that unfolding as America's demographics change. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. In other news this week, anti-Japan protests raged across China over disputed islands in the East China Sea.
What worries many is that this aggressive nationalism appears to be on the rise in China, and so too are tensions with many of its neighbours. What that means is even a small incident could set off a dangerous dynamic.
A congressional gold medal in Washington this week for Burma, Myanmar's celebrated reform fighter Aung San Suu Kyi.
In spite of the imperfections, democracy still remains a beacon of hope for all of us.
And a biting new musical satire from songwriter Randy Newman with the refrain, I'm dreaming of a white president.
I'm dreaming of a white president, just like the ones we've always had. A real live white man who knows the score, how to handle money or start a war.
Randy Newman bites again. Ginger Gibson is with us today from Politico. Trudy Rubin from the Philadelphia Inquirer. Our own Jack Beatty. We're looking at a week in the news. Trudy, let me come to you. A lot of listeners commenting online about what we've seen in the Muslim world. Ed here writes, as the Middle East is in danger of being taken over by radical Islamists, the Obama administration might go down in history as the one that lost the chance of the Arab Spring for democracy to radical Islamists, which led to a larger global conflict. But you can hear, Trudy, that people's fears and concern are really up about what we're seeing on television screens. How do you interpret what's happening here?
I don't think history will show that Obama lost the Muslim world. I think there is a historic phenomenon going on in the Arab world and elsewhere that has been building for a long time, and the fall of dictators unleashed it. But what I will say is that I think the Obama administration and various embassies should stop apologizing for that anti-Muslim film that was put together by a crank, an Islamophobic prank in California, because apologies just won't help at this point. And the whole world cannot police itself to avoid the sensibilities of some Muslims, and I emphasize some, because what is going on in the Arab world and in Pakistan today is organized, manipulated, is playing on emotions that have to do with many other things besides pride in Islam. When you look at the various countries, you see that either Islamic parties, hardline Islamic parties, or radical groups took advantage of this. If it wasn't this film, they would have found something else. They use it to whip up mob sentiment. And governments are in that region, new governments are playing to the mob, or they are just too weak to stand up to the mob. You see it in Pakistan today, where the government called for a Love Muhammad Day, which turns into violence because you have radical Islamic parties in Pakistan who will stir up the crowd. In a country where a third of children don't even go to any school at all, and the literacy rate is only 57%. There are all kinds of grievances, and so radical parties play on the anger of the crowd and cynically and deliberately play this up.
But how do we break out of this dynamic, Rudy? I mean, cranks or haters here, mobs, manipulators there. Plus, people just really taking offense at, you know, whether it's the video or the stuff in the French magazine this week of a nude prophet. How do you break out of that in the YouTube age?
I think that the U.S. government can only do and should only do certain things. First of all, insist on the rule of law. Governments around the world have a duty to protect embassies, to protect personnel, and if they don't, frankly, we shouldn't be giving them aid. That is the position that I have come to, because respect goes two ways and rule of law has to be observed. You had a very interesting statement from the Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia, which is ironic because Saudi Arabia has given a lot of money to radical Islamic groups. Mm-hmm. But in this statement, what he basically said was that neither the Muslim religion nor the Prophet Muhammad would tolerate this kind of thing, that they are greater than some perceived insult, and that breaking the law is not a way to honor them. And I think that's a message that we have to give out, and we have to give out a message that we expect governments in the Islamic world to do their duty and to protect embassies, personnel, business people. Otherwise, there will not be investment, there will not be foreign aid, and we will just have to deal with them issue by issue, but not apologize for things that are legal within our system.
Of course, there's legal, but for example, in Egypt, it's not Mubarak anymore. It's not that hand in glove with the military. Ginger Gibson, how do you think the Obama administration is coming through this? I mean, there's criticism this week about security for that consulate in Benghazi in Libya. They shifted their tune from something, you know, talking more about protest to straight up labeling it terrorism in the last day or two. How do you think they're weathering this?
In the last day, they have come out and said, you know, this was a planned terrorist attack, not part of spontaneous protest. They're trying to handle this in a way that shows that President Obama and the White House are in command of the U.S. foreign policy. There was, the whole uproar began. And as the criticism began, they got a tiny bit of cover because Mitt Romney came out and very quickly criticized the president before all the details were out. And then there was all the criticism for Mitt Romney and Republicans on the defensive of Mitt Romney. So the criticism got muddled as it came from both sides. But as we get a little farther away and more details start to come out, we see that it hasn't hurt Obama, who has consistently led in the polls when it comes to the issue of foreign policy, which is very unusual for a Democrat to be up on that issue over a Republican. But it also hasn't hurt Mitt Romney. The polls, voters who were aware of it, didn't really think less of him for his response either.
Jack, a week ago, you were talking with us about these reports of a more pointed, targeted, militant attack. I guess that would qualify as terrorism. But still, here was on Sunday still, UN Ambassador, President Obama's Ambassador to the United Nations, Susan Rice, who was on Meet the Press, talked about the attacks on the American Embassy in Libya in protest terms.
This is a spontaneous reaction to a video, and it's not dissimilar, but perhaps on a slightly larger scale than what we have seen in the past with the satanic verses with the cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad.
Jack, justified criticism of the Obama administration for not being adequately on its toes when it came to the threat here?
Absolutely. And I was very surprised to see Ambassador Rice say that. You know, that statement lagged, I think, even then, and certainly subsequently, what the Libyan government itself was saying. And there she was trying to put this, acceptable political face on what looks to be a condign lapse in security on the part of our State Department, the government. And, it's something. The Obama administration was behind the curve going into the Arab Spring. Remember, they were sort of a week or two behind events in Egypt, or it seemed that way at least. They couldn't quite, they didn't quite imagine that things from Tunisia could roll that fast. Well, there's something of surprise here, too. Well, they didn't quite imagine that there might be an attack arranged for September 11th on a very vulnerable U.S. consulate. And I think the Republicans are going to investigate it. They've already said so. And it might be uncomfortable for the administration.
Let's go to Wayne in Nashville, Tennessee. Wayne, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. Dealing with the issue with the Middle East, that what we need to do as a country is get much more involved diplomatically with the major players in the region, especially the Saudis. And we need, as a nation, to support the Saudi Arabian efforts to create an Arab Union. Backing them in their efforts to create an Arab Union will give us much more diplomatic clout through the Saudis, and we can work through the Saudis to help these new emerging governments in the Middle East.
But, Wayne, will that still work? I mean, the Saudis are kind of the pushback against the Arab Spring. Everybody says that's the way of the future. If we tie up with the Saudis, are we tying up with the past?
No, because the Saudis right now are one of the areas of this nation that we're starting to increase our exports to, and if we're able to support the Saudis and increase our exports to the Saudi Arabian governments, we'll open up other markets and other opportunities diplomatically throughout the region.
Let us look at it. Trudy, what do you say?
I'm not aware that the Saudis are trying to create an Arab Union, and if they were, it would fall flat on its face. I mean, the Saudis are good at spreading money around, but there isn't going to be an Arab Union. I think we have to look at these cases country by country. And we have to help those governments that are willing to work with us and those that are not. They're not our enemies, but we cannot pretend that they're our friends. What do I mean? In Libya, I think the government is truly trying. They apologized for these incidents. I think we had a serious security breach. We should work with them to try to improve their security. In Tunisia, the government was also way behind the curve. They're afraid of hardline Islamists, but they do want to have connections with the West, and I think we should try to continue to help them with aid. Egypt is far more complicated. It is a government of the Muslim Brotherhood Party. They helped stir up trouble. They are afraid of the hardline Islamists on their flank. If they are not willing to take a firm stand, protect law and order, then I think we should think twice about the loan forgiveness that they are asking us for. I think we have a right to ask governments to play by international rules, and we can't kid ourselves that just talking nice and apologizing will make them our friends.
Trudy, turn with us, if you would, for a minute to China. This dispute over the islands in the East China Sea, big demonstrations in China this week. Leon Panetta, of course, was around Beijing in China in recent days. But so much passion there over territory in that disputed territory. The back of our minds here, you know, the U.S. is allied with Japan. How far does this go? Here's a protester in China explaining to Al Jazeera on Tuesday why he was so angry with Japan.
New hatred is piled upon old ones. This is to say Japan hasn't apologized, compensated, nor reflected upon their war crimes. And now they've become even more aggressive and invaded our country's Ryukyu Islands.
An anniversary of the invasion of Manchuria by Japanese troops way back in the 30s, still very much on the minds of Chinese this week. What about those huge demos, Trudy, and where this goes? And is the United States some risk of being pulled into a regional fight here?
One thing that I think Americans often don't realize is the intensity of the anti-Japanese feeling that still exists in China. I've been surprised at it when I've talked to young professional Chinese and I've had them use the hate word. Young people, a manager of a food chain saying to me, "We hate the Japanese." They are taught in school about the Japanese crimes during World War II, which were heinous, and the Japanese have a checkered record of not really apologizing for them. On the other hand, I think that the United States does have interests and allies in the region, and Obama has gone out on a limb on this.
How so?
The word pivot was used off the record by an Obama aide, but the Obama team has talked about rebalancing towards Asia. Mm-hmm. I don't think it will be so easy to just turn away from the Middle East and South Asia, which are going to take up a lot of our time still. But Obama has made a commitment and is encouraging other countries in the region, Japan, which is an ally, Southeast Asian countries, to try to work together in order to allow China, yes, to rise, but not to dominate or impose, especially with boundary disputes over islands in waters underneath which there are resources. Yep. Now, we've gone out on a limb and we've talked about our role as an Asian power. The Chinese are obviously going to be annoyed at this. And I think it's going to be a delicate road to walk.
But once you've made the pivot, it's hard to look away when things get dicey.
Exactly. And it's also a question of resources because it involves ships, and ships cost money. So it's going to be a difficult road to walk. But I think having made this commitment, the Obama team and Leon Panetta, Secretary of Defense, when he was out there this week, he was trying to tell the Chinese, this is not against you. This is just we're not taking sides, but we want a peaceful region. But I think that's going to have to be a firm message, peaceful region. The Chinese are going to resist it.
May not be entirely in our control. Trudy, I've got to bring it home here to Chicago, right, where we wrapped up a teacher strike this week. Here was Rahm Emanuel, Chicago mayor, on Tuesday.
This settlement is an honest compromise. It means returning our schools to their primary purpose, the education of our children. It means a new day and a new direction for the Chicago Public Schools. In this contract, we gave our children a seat at the table. In past negotiations, taxpayers paid more, but our kids got less. This time, our taxpayers are paying less, and our kids are getting more.
Jack Beatty, there's the Chicago mayor, says we're in a new direction here. The teachers union president, Karen Lewis, said we're moving in the right direction. But what direction does this settlement and this whole strike chapter establish, Jack?
Well, you know, the mayor said that kids had a seat at the table. But you know, what's the size of that seat? I saw an interview with a teacher from Chicago who had a class. He was a high school teacher of 41. I mean, what kind of a break are the kids getting there? On the other hand, there's this huge financial crunch that Chicago has that's going to get worse with their pension obligations. So there's a victory. The kids are back to school. But what kind of education are they going to get there? We've talked about the dreadful numbers out of Chicago, not dissimilar to other big cities. We've got to do better. I mean, we talk of China. I mean, they don't just write off, it seems to me, whole segments, well, maybe they do, of the population, but we shouldn't.
It's a big population. Ginger, right. Where does this turn teachers in the political calculus, this whole incident? He was President Obama's chief of staff. Here he was eyeball to eyeball with the teachers union in Chicago. Where do they come down in November, Ginger?
The teachers union is going to come down with Democrats, but it's important to remember that when Obama passed Race to the Top, they weren't thrilled. And so they're not the biggest fans of the Obama administration, but have no doubt that they are wholeheartedly coming down on the left.
Well, we're glad Chicago made it through that pass and the kids are back to school there at least. We'll see how that tilts that whole debate around reform in the weeks and months ahead. Ginger Gibson with Politico, been great to have you with us today. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
Trudy Rubin, Philadelphia Inquirer. Thank you, Trudy.
Great to be here.
And Jack, thanks as always.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.